of Black women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Joshua Wright. Joshua Wright is the author of The NBA's Global Empire, How the League Became an International Powerhouse. Joshua Wright is an associate professor of history in the Global Studies Department at Trinity Washington University here in D.C. How are you doing today, Joshua?
Hey, good morning. I'm great. Thank you so much.
Well, good to see you. I got some questions. I was reading the newspaper, and I want to ask you two questions about two articles I saw and how it relates to your book, okay?
Okay.
The first one was recently in the New York Times, and it said, the WNBA is a big draw for players from abroad, okay? I wouldn't say that because in the epilogue of your book, you write, ironically, the WNBA lags in globalization. Okay, so talk about the WNBA because my take on it is that, and similar to things that are in your book, the next Olympics might have Caitlin Clark and Paige Beckers. It might be like a dream team for women that might really be another level that this women's basketball takes to. And I don't know if you agree with me or disagree with me on that.
Yeah, that's great. And it's funny you mentioned Caitlin Clark because she's been in the news quite a bit the last 48 hours after she got knocked down and it led to a scuffle in a game. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the WNBA, it's in a great place right this moment over the last year, you know, going on 2 years now because of Caitlin Clark and how she's really elevated that game. And, you know, you could predict that from, you know, when you go back to when she was in college playing against Angel Reese and what she was doing at Iowa. In terms of globalization, the WNBA is getting its first international team next year. It's going to be in Toronto. Similar to the NBA, because if you think about it, with the NBA, when they had their first expansion teams overseas, you had two teams in Canada, one in Toronto and one in Vancouver. In terms of the number of international players in that league, it's been fairly low. It's starting to pick up now. For example, this past WNBA draft, which was held back in April, you had five international players who got drafted. You also had the number two pick in that draft, a woman by the name of Dominique Malanga, who was from France, a 6'6 center from France, who's compared to Victor Wembanyama in the NBA, was taken. And they say she's going to really revolutionize the game in the future moving forward. So back to what you were saying with the 2028 Olympics that are going to be happening in Los Angeles. Yeah, I think that will be a great time for a Caitlin Clark, an Angel Reese, an Aja Wilson, and some of these other new players coming into the league to really market that league on a global stage. One of the reasons that the WNBA, and I mentioned this in the book, has been struggling in terms of bringing over international players recently was a few factors. One, the WNBA up until now hadn't really been that successful when you talk about the different American sports leagues in terms of attracting viewers, in terms of attracting sponsors. I was just hearing yesterday that despite all the good things that Caitlin Clark was doing for the league, they still lost a lot of money last season. So the WNBA didn't have money to play players. It still really doesn't have money to play players. That's why you had Brittany Griner. Remember the long story about her, how she got arrested.
Had to go overseas, right?
Yeah, right, in Russia. Well, the reason Griner was playing in Russia and the reason that other players from that league, that like Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird, were going overseas to play in the offseason was because you can make over $1 million playing for Russia or playing for some country overseas, while in the WNBA, that pay that they were receiving was very, very low. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but I think, for example, like a rookie contract for the WNBA was under $100,000 a year, right? You know, so it wasn't that much, you know, so it made more sense to go play overseas. And if you were already living overseas, why leave your country to come here and make less money? Also, you know, a lot of those players overseas have national pride, and they not only want to play for the team that they're from, but they also want to be able to play for the national team, for FIBA competitions and things of that nature.
You know, the second article deals with the news story about the recent expansion of lists of countries that the U.S. is now banning people entry from. That was also in the New York Times. And I mentioned that because in the back of your book, you said, well, you know, if I had been able to travel, you know, I could have done more research. I'm looking at also how many scholars access to grants, you know, might be tied. But then I'm also looking at, you know, this barrier that might prevent athletes from coming from certain countries into the United States.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Now, you know, one thing I think will be interesting when we talk about globalization of the NBA, a lot of times, especially people within the popular sports media networks like ESPN, Fox, tend to mostly focus on the European players coming over. And right now, the majority of foreign players in the NBA are from Europe, but that's expanded. You know, we you know Africa is becoming a really hotbed for talent. Coach Jim Boeheim, the former coach of Syracuse, said that Africa is probably going to be the number one destination for players in the near future from the NBA.
You know,
We
when you
have
say that, I was thinking about the Olympics where Sudan really gave the U.S. a really challenge. You know, them brothers were serious.
South Sudan, right? The team that didn't even have an indoor gymnasium to play in. The Team USA was supposed to beat by 40 points, and they barely beat them by just a few points. And you know, that team had they really didn't have a lot of NBA talent on that roster, but that shows you that Africa is coming. So, you know, I think you'll see more players coming from Africa. You know, we haven't really seen a lot of players coming out of China. We had Yao Ming back in the 2000s, but we've not seen a lot of players come out of China. But we know the NBA is very popular in China. So my point is, it's not just Europe, you know, it's other parts of the globe where players will be coming from. But you know, for the present moment, because so many players are coming from Europe, and now we see a lot of players coming out of France, you know, I don't think these travel bans would necessarily hurt the NBA in terms of getting that foreign talent. You know, we'll have to see what happens moving forward. I know President Trump is in his first term right now, and you know, we'll have to see what happens, you know, come the next election season if we have a continuation of you know, Trump and the MAGA movement, or if we have you know, new leadership coming in who's going to be more welcoming to foreigners.
But go back to Yao Ming, because if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Yao Ming like on loan to the United States?
Not that I know of, and I could go back and check my research on that, but not think he was on loan to us.
You know, like I don't want to compare it to like the Panda Bears, but you know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, like they really meant to make sure that he came back to China.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure, but like I do know that because in the book I talk a little bit about the NBA in comparison to Major League Baseball and the NFL when it comes to globalization. And I do remember a story of a baseball player from Asia who came over kind of like what you said, somewhat on loan, where his contract said that at the end of his first season he had the option to return home or he could stay here in the United States and continue playing ball, and he ended up returning. But you know, I know in Yao Ming's case, he was here for quite a while, and then he did eventually go back to China and he became the president of the China Basketball Association.
All right. You know, I want to get into this globalization because it seems right now we're in a period of time with especially the Trump administration of rejecting globalization. In your book, you define globalization as the process of interaction and integration among companies, governments, people, and cultures around the world. Would you want to add anything to that definition?
I think, you know, the spread of ideas, obviously. I think, you know, when we talk about military conflicts that we've been seeing, I think some of that is a result of globalization. A simpler version that I use when I'm in class and I'm teaching, I do an introduction to global affairs course from time to time at my university, Trinity, Washington, in DC. And, you know, the simplest version I would tell my students is, okay, if you look at say the hoodie that I'm currently wearing, all right, you know, this hoodie has traveled all over the globe. The cotton may have come from Lubbock, Texas. It then may have been, you know, manufactured in a sweatshop in Vietnam or, you know, Indonesia.
And I want to I see, I'm looking at you on Zoom. I want to let people know that your hoodie is not up.
You know, and then you may have seen, you know, from there, this hoodie then may be sold here in the United States, unused hoodies that don't get sold may end up going to countries in Africa. So, that's kind of like an easy way where I say, globalization is all around us. It's what we wear, it's what we eat. It's the fact that I could go downtown DC and go to a Thai restaurant, and then I could go next door to a Korean restaurant or a Nigerian restaurant. It's the music we listen to. So globalization is all around us. And I mean, it's, definitely a huge part of sports. It's the reason why my Commanders are going to be playing in Madrid, Spain later this year.
You know, when I think of globalization, to me, the best example in sports is probably the World Cup. I wonder if you agree. Would you agree with that? And I feel that, soccer was always international, and it was just, had to catch up here in terms of the U.S. And I felt that women's soccer really opened the door, to it. But when I think of this, looking at how the countries are competing and things of that sort, I remember, for example, here in Washington, D.C., during one of the World Cup, DuPont Circle had a big screen, and it was just so many different people rooting against, I think, England. It was all these people, all these people from various countries around the world who had been subjugated by England. But it came an opportunity for this nationalism to play out in such a way that it's not destructive but constructive.
And even too, and I'll admit I'm not a huge soccer fan. I follow all sports for the most part, but I think more so of, and definitely the World Cup, I would say is an example of globalization. But the Olympics, like I'm a huge fan of the Olympics. I watch the Olympics religiously every summer. I'm not as big into the Winter Olympics, but the Summer Olympics I've always followed. And what I really like about the Olympics is when you see the opening night ceremony
Wait a
and
minute, go back. Wait a minute. You mean you were against the Jamaican bobsled group?
I mean, you gotta root for the brothers from the islands, of course, but
We skating, man. We like skiing, man. Come on.
I mean, I guess we're diversifying the Winter Olympics. I know the Winter Olympics is going to be coming up, I believe next February in Italy, I think. So hopefully we'll see some more diversity at the Winter Olympics. But going back to the Summer Olympics, if you watch the opening ceremony, I love it how you see all of the people representing their countries and everyone comes out and they're wearing the colors and they're waving their flags and you see everybody coming together. And then at the end, I don't think they do it at the opening ceremony, but I know at the closing ceremony, they turn it into like this big party where people break apart from their delegations and everybody starts intermingling with each other and mixing with each other and dancing. And regardless of whatever's happening, and I know the Olympics has been, tied to politics and different events over the years, but a lot of times, regardless of what's happening in the world, it's like we take a break just for a moment and everybody could just be human. It doesn't have to be I'm American, I'm British, I'm France, I'm from whatever country you're from. We could just all be enjoying each other and really mixing and you see people getting along and young people coming together. So I think that's a beautiful part of globalization of sports that you get from that Olympic spirit.
I was wondering, Joshua Wright, when it comes to globalization, are companies more important than governments?
Companies more important than governments.
You think of Nike, I mean,
Yeah.
these are companies that seem to drive the country comes along after these companies of making their deals.
That's a great question. That's a great question. That's a really great question. Because I had someone ask me once, did I think that, that some of the actions that were happening in the White House and what President Trump was doing, would that hurt, American sports overseas in terms of the basketball and football? And what I told them was, in some ways, yes, but in other ways, no, because I think that to some extent, people could separate what you're seeing on the field and on the court from maybe what's happening politically. And I know like a lot of times sports and politics go hand in hand, but I do think that there is somewhat of a cognitive dissonance that people could separate. So when you think about a Nike, I think that Nike does have the, companies like Nike could go out, they could market these athletes, people like Jordan back in the day or Kobe, and they could sell them overseas and they could make a lot of money. despite whatever may be happening in that particular country or in that particular government. But it's tricky though, right? It is tricky because, you look about, you think about these different foreign deals that are happening with these companies, and you'll have people like yourself, like me, who may say, well, I can't support what you're doing financially because, you're supporting this country or you're backed by this particular country, which condones all these various types of crimes against people and exploitation against people. And you know what I mean? So that's the tricky part of it. Even, in the book, I get into Nike and how Nike was a part of the Beijing Olympics back in 2008. And you had folks who were protesting that and saying, well, how can you support this? And they were coming down on the Nike athletes from America who were out there like Kobe and LeBron, who were wearing the Nike logos and the sneakers. And people were saying, like, you need to say something about what China is doing. And, because Nike had like a foothold in China, was making so much money and there was so much investment in it. And the NBA too, those players really couldn't say anything because at the end of the day, they could. I mean, they could, but they chose not to because it would hurt the bottom line for Nike and for the NBA and for themselves as well if they want to keep making money.
When I think about the NBA and globalization, I think about the NBA commissioners, David Stern and Adam Silver. And I want you to talk about these two men because you mentioned in your book that one time Stern opposed globalization.
I mean, and it's funny because David Stern was such a visionary. He was such a forward thinker. David Stern, for listeners who may not be familiar with that name, he was the commissioner of the NBA, came in 1984, the same year you get Michael Jordan and you get Charles Barkley entering the NBA. And he was a commissioner of the league for about, I want to say, 30 to 35 years before he stepped down and was replaced by the current commissioner, Adam Silver. And David Stern, he was the one who made the television deal for the NBA to be broadcast on Turner, Ted Turner's network. So it goes to TNT. And I know the NBA recently lost that partnership with TNT, but it goes to TNT, it goes to TBS. And then eventually you would have the deal with ESPN. And, the NBA being on cable was a big part of it, being able to expand all across the nation, but also overseas, right? In terms of globalization, he was offered the chance to get NBA players involved in world competitions, right? The FIBA World Cup and the Summer Olympics. And Stern didn't really think that was profitable. And that's why I think to me that's always interesting because, again, he was so visionary and, he was definitely a capitalist. So it's surprising to me that he didn't see the potential in it. But what he said was, how does this benefit my players playing in the World Cup in the summer, playing in the Olympics every 4 years? Because, prior to the Dream Team in 92, we only sent our college students in the very, very beginning. When you start Olympic competition in basketball in 1936 in Berlin, in the very beginning, the players we sent over were coming from AAU teams. And then later it becomes AAU and college players, and then after the 60s, it's just strictly college players. It's our best college players going over there. And because we lost, we lose in the 70s. It was a, controversial loss to the Soviet Union, but we lost fair and square in 1988, playing a bunch of college kids against what were essentially pro players from the other nations. And then that's what leads to the Dream Team. But you had folks such as the FIBA president, Boris Stankovic. You had Dave Gavitt, who was the president of USA Basketball and the founder of the Big East Conference, who were proponents of getting American players, particularly American players from the NBA, getting the NBA players involved in these international competitions. And they really had to, pull David Stern's arm to get him to see that this was a good idea. And maybe, it was losing in 1988 that really helped to, open the doors for this once folks said that, hey, we can't keep sending our boys over there if they're going to lose like this. So Stern gets on board, he finally supports this idea to start sending the players there in 92. And as I say in the first chapter in the book, like the Dream Team, I mean, we talk about patriotism and all of these things, but I mean, the Dream Team really was a big commercial for the NBA. And I think Stern realized that once he got the players over there, and once, you had Nike, which was involved in it, Reebok too, right? And there's some controversy about Reebok's participation in the Olympics and supporting the basketball team. But once everybody got over there and they saw that this was a great opportunity to really sell the league, I think, that's what set the ball rolling from that point forward in terms of, us sending our best players overseas, but then also the NBA marketing their game to, all of these different countries. I mean, we don't have the NBA that we have right now under Adam Silver, with all of these international
Let's talk about
players.
Adam Silver. Where is he taking the league?
Yeah, I mean, Adam Silver. Adam Silver comes in. He was, David Stern's number two for a number of years before he steps in the late 2010s and takes the league over. And when Adam Silver gets the league, he comes in at a great moment because you think about it, you have David Stern in the 1980s, at the start of globalization really taking off in the NBA. And, it's important to note that that wasn't the first time that the NBA had, players involved in international competitions in the Olympics, but that was the time when it really takes off. So you get Stern there, you had Stern with the cable revolution in the 1990s. Then as you get into the 2000s, you have the internet, right, in the digital age. And when Silver comes in the 2010s, he's coming in at a great point because now the NBA has expanded digitally. You have websites overseas. I know Silver talks about the fact that, one of the reasons that Kobe Bryant was so beloved overseas was because Kobe comes in the league in 96, right around the same time when the NBA launches its first website over in China. And Kobe really embraced that. So you have players like Kobe who were getting involved that way, being able to communicate with fans in different parts of the globe. You'll see a Yao Ming coming into the league around 2003, 2000, 2002. Between 2002 and 2003, you have the Yao Ming coming into the league. And then more and more players are coming from overseas, especially from Europe. There's this.
Well, let's go back to China again because you mentioned Yao Ming and you mentioned Kobe. But there's another player who I felt was the bigger player over there, and that was Stephon Marbury.
But well,
Because
Marbury.
he had the sneaker contract, he had everything go. He had a real business over there. I mean,
But Marbury is, yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely Stephon Marbury is big, but Yao Ming comes before, Marbury, right? Because Marbury comes in the
But
league.
I'm talking about Stephon Marbury's presence in China.
Right. Yeah. No, I know. But, I think like in terms of just the timeline, you remember Marbury comes in the league in that 1996 class with Kobe and Iverson. And, when Yao Ming gets to the league in the early 2000s, Stephon is still playing in the NBA, And, Stephon's going to travel from different teams
But
and
let's go
Stephon.
back. Let's go back. So you get a pick, and this happened to me back then. Who do you take, Stephon Marbury or Iverson?
You gotta go Iverson, man. You
See,
gotta go Iverson. Iverson.
I thought Marbury in college was a little better,
You gotta go Iverson. So, well, I don't want us to get, off on a tangent, but I will just say, Allen Iverson, I think, you just think about his career, and people get on him for being inefficient and everything. And, in terms of like analytics, people downplay Allen Iverson's greatness today. But Iverson, I mean, to be 6 foot, 170, 80 pounds, to take a team to the NBA finals, to win at least one game against a dominant Lakers team,
Right,
win
but
the
see, this
MVP.
is what I wasn't going off channel. What I was looking at was the fact that Marbury reminds me, and I'm a baseball person, reminds me of a guy who's playing baseball, not really great, but then goes over to Japan and hits home runs and stuff like that, and becomes like a really, bigger. I felt Marbury was bigger in China than he was here in the States.
No, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the point I was trying to make was I think Yao Ming, he really like pushed down the door in terms of the NBA's popularity in China, right? And I think in some ways he may have made it easier for Stephon by the time Marbury arrives over in China. I don't remember off the top of my head what year he gets to China, but I know his career in the NBA kind of fizzles out And then he goes over to China as a way to kind of like resurrect himself. And I think it was easier for him to be embraced in some instances because not just Yao Ming, because the NBA had really been embraced by China, because of the websites, because of streaming, because of the games being broadcast over there, all of these different things that David Stern, helped to set up, right? So when Marbury gets to China and he plays over there, he wins a championship, he becomes a coach, they create a film about him, they build a statue to him. He does all of these great things, and he does have this amazing second career over in China. And I do agree with you. Like, he was better over in China than he was here in the United States. But I don't want to just, kind of like downplay like
No,
the impact of.
I know you're not. You're a very nice guy, Josh. I don't want you to. But I do want, before we take our break, I want to ask you about one other person who I think has a significant influence in terms of globalization, and that's Elijah Wan. And I think about the fact that this is a person who is a devout Muslim who really raised the whole thing. Like, okay, I've got to play basketball during Ramadan. I'm fasting, and that sort of elevated. I think we recently had on UConn, there was a young woman there on the team, with the championship team, who I think she was from Egypt and she was a Muslim, and she, I think Paige Beckett was helping her get ready through, Ramadan. But you see that the whole thing that these players now, if they're a Muslim player, that makes it possible for to play sports.
No, I agree. I agree. And Elijah Wan, I mean, he was just so impactful in so many different ways. Not just the fact that he made it acceptable for Muslim players to be in the NBA or to play sports professionally over here in the United States, but just in terms of what he did when you talk about Africa. I mentioned how Africa is going to become like a future destination for a lot of our NBA talent. Elijah Wan, the success he had here with the Houston Rockets, the success he's had as a global ambassador since he's retired. I mean, you can't say enough about that, brother.
Well, we're gonna take a little break and get back into the whole thing of not just globalization but also diplomacy. My guest today is Joshua Wright. He's the author of The NBA's Global Empire: How the League Became an International Powerhouse. He's also an associate professor of history in the Global Studies Department at Trinity Washington University here in D.C. The show's On the Margin. My name is Yothbert Brett Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Are you ready for this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m.? WPFW, in collaboration with Washington Parks and People, present the Jazz and Justice Festival. This event is an activation of music, poetry, social justice and labor teach-ins, elders circle, visual art, wellness circle, and a kids' corner in Malcolm X Park. Performers include Saiz Kamaluddin, Lena Saikali, Lady Murr and Friends, Paul Bailey Quartet, Blacks, Myths, Substantial with DJ RBI, Kaba Soul Singer, Proverbs Reggae Band, and the Soul Searchers, with sets by DJ Abby, Lance Reynolds, Rita Burns, and Underdog. There will also be an art exhibition curated by Adrian Ferguson of The Art of Noise, a film activation curated by Jordan Strudwick, and a community presented by Milani Douglas. The Jazz and Justice Festival this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Park. An afternoon of joy as resistance. Details at WPFWFM.org. Oh, 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 I got
my boots on the ground. Okay, we're back here with our boots on the ground with Joshua Wright. And we were talking about this book, The NBA's Global Empire: How the League Became an International Powerhouse. Just look at our, go to this chapter that you have in your book, Josh. When you talk about basketball and diplomacy, and you begin with the Harlem Globetrotters, talk about the Harlem Globetrotters and how important they were in terms of becoming diplomats on, on the world stage.
Yeah, well, a lot of people think about the Harlem Globetrotters as the clowns of the NBA, the clown princes of the NBA, Sweet Georgia Brown, all those different things. But the owner of the Globetrotters had this idea that we need to really sell this idea that this is a team that travels the world. And the Globetrotters start taking all of these foreign trips. And they eventually end up becoming like these unofficial ambassadors on behalf of the United States Department, right? So if you think about the jazz diplomats that we had, right? And Louis Armstrong and those various jazz musicians that were going overseas during the Cold War, helping to kind of spread this idea that American democracy was good, that America didn't have all of these racial tensions that we knew it had. It was similar with that, right? Whether it's the jazz diplomats, even like the ping pong diplomacy too, you had the Globetrotters going all around the world, spreading goodwill on behalf of America. And I talk in the book about how the Globetrotters would sip tea with the Queen, and they would meet with the Pope, and people would come out to see them. And in the book, I mentioned how more recently you had the Globetrotters, members of the current version of the Globetrotters, traveling overseas to North Korea with former NBA star Dennis Rodman, going on this so-called goodwill game. Now, that game that they did, the more recent game when they go to North Korea, that was not sponsored by the US government, right? That was something that was set up by Vice magazine. And they went over there and they played this exhibition game in front of the the president of North Korea and all the people over there. But no, I mean, the Globetrotters, I think, were the original version of basketball diplomats from the United States.
I mean, the backdrop of that is definitely, this is Cold War politics and using, culture as a way of having U.S. inroads into these regions. And I'm looking at what we see happening today, and I want to get your comments on in terms of, it seems like a major player on the world stage is Saudi Arabia, who seems like they want to be the center, and also Qatar, they want to be the center in terms of golf, boxing, I think, is another thing they're looking at. But there's a, talk about that presence and how that changes the dynamic, because it's not the US and Europe, but now just Saudi Arabia seems to be on the world stage.
Yeah, and there's a lot of controversy with that. I think you mentioned golf, and you had this big debate in golf recently, where you had the PGA Professional Golf Association versus LIV, and LIV was this new, golf organization that was funded by the Saudis, and you had some U.S. players who were taking the money to play for the Saudi tour, for the LIV tour, because it was so much more money that they had to give. And then you had folks here saying, well, that's blood money. You can't do that. Saudi Arabia had ties to September 11th. And, and Saudi Arabia has, these various atrocities that the government, does nothing about. So that became a thing, right? And, now there's kind of like this partnership somewhat between like PGA and LIV in terms of basketball. You mentioned boxing too. I know that there have been some fights. I think there was a fight not too long ago that was over in Saudi Arabia. Because fighters can go over there instead of fighting here at Madison Square Garden or fighting over in Vegas, they could go to Saudi Arabia and they can make all of this money. In the NBA, there is it's a Saudi, I want to say it's a sovereignty fund, which has recently has ties to the Monumental Sports here in Washington, D.C. So that's the Washington Wizards, that's the Washington Mystics WNBA team, right? So Saudi is, starting to have more of a presence. And Adam Silver was asked about this, and he didn't really say that he had an issue doing business with some of those governments, but it becomes an issue of sports washing, right? This term where you see whether Saudi Arabia, whether it is China, Qatar, some other countries, you'll see countries who have records of, human rights violations using sports almost as a shield, right? Because it's like, hey, we're gonna host the World Cup, we're gonna host the Olympics, we're gonna host boxing events and, buy into sporting, organizations, associations in the United States. And, sports is gonna make people kind of like overlook and forget whatever atrocities are happening in our country, right? So we walk this tightrope, whereas if you're an American company like the NBA, you have to say, am I willing to make a deal? Am I willing to work with this country for the sake of you know, selling the sport abroad, for the sake of making money, even though we may not agree with everything that they're doing. The NBA, you know, they have a series of international games now. And one of the international series they've been doing recently is in Abu Dhabi, right? The United Arab Emirates. They have it's like a two-night exhibition they do in the preseason in October. I think the Knicks and the Philadelphia 76ers are playing in this year's game in October. But, you know, that part of the world has been criticized for a number of issues, right? One being the treatment of people of homosexuals, right? But, you know, the NBA, again, it's like, do we work with them? Obviously, the NBA did choose to work with them, but it's like, do we work with them? Do we put, as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar once said, you know, do we put commerce over conscience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask you this. I'm to change you from being a professor to being a business person. Removing all of the NBA players who were born outside the U.S., who would be the face of the NBA going into the future that you say, okay, like I can package this American basketball player, you know, the way Michael Jordan was, okay? Because most of the people, you know, that in your book are from outside the U.S. But if we just had to go with a face that we can say, okay, this is like U.S. Steel. This is an American basketball player on the world stage. The same way in the World Baseball Classic, you got Mike Trout, you know. So, but is there any American player that is the future face of the NBA, or are they all going to be from outside the U.S.?
So, one, thank you for this question, because this issue of the face of the league has been really on my mind a lot the last month, partly just because they keep talking about it nonstop in the media. But no, truthfully, while I have a joke and then I'll give an actual answer, my joke is Caitlin Clark is going to be the face of the league. I mean, if she could play men's basketball, and I know Ice Cube had recruited her to the Big Three last year, if she could play men's basketball, she would be the face of the league, because I heard somebody say the other day that she might be the most popular American athlete, period, right now. But in terms of, realistically, though, to be serious, in terms of the NBA, the face of the league, I'm working on this article right now, which I hope gets published, about Cooper Flagg, the freshman, former freshman coming out of Duke University, 18-year-old white American-born player from Maine. And while I don't think that Flagg could necessarily be as big as Caitlin Clark, I do think that Flagg could have a huge impact on the NBA, because he not only would be American-born, but he'd be in a white American superstar. And we haven't really had that since, you know, you got to go all the way back to Larry Bird in the 1980s. The last time we had a white American superstar. If, you know, so again, Flagg is the person I'm looking at moving forward. I think he's in a great situation right now playing in Dallas. If, you know, Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving and some of those guys out there can stay healthy. But with the guys who are currently in the league, since, you know, we don't know how good Flagg will be, with the current roster, the person everyone is pushing is Anthony Edwards from the Minnesota Timberwolves. I'm not a huge Anthony Edwards fan. I understand why they're pushing him, because of the way he plays and his, you know, charismatic personality.
Someone says he doesn't really want to be the face of the league.
Yeah, and he said that, and I've heard folks say that, well, you can't make that up for you. Like, the people determine, like, the people based on if you're a box office, if they come to see you when you come to town, you know, if they buy your sneakers, if they buy whatever you're endorsing, you know, the people automatically will make you the face of the league.
Let's add the other thing, Josh. Josh, you're right. Okay. You've got to win championships. Okay.
Right.
If you're going to be the face of the league, you have to win some championships. You're going to have some rings.
Well, yeah, yes. You know, here's the thing. Yes and no. Yes and no to that, right? Because I, for one, if we're talking solely American players and taking Cooper Flagg out of the equation since he's not been drafted yet, I, for one, think that the American player who should actually be the face of the league isn't Anthony Edwards, but it's Jason Tatum. Because, one, like you said, you have to win rings. He has a ring. He's played in the NBA Finals twice already. He's been all NBA first team for the last 3 or 4 years. He has a number of accolades. He's playing for the Boston Celtics, which, along with the Lakers, is the, premier team in the NBA. He's clean cut. He comes from Duke University. He, to me, really should be the face of the league, but it's
Joshua,
not. It's,
Joshua, Joshua.
but hold on, hold on, hold on, hold
Okay, go
on,
ahead. Go ahead,
hold
Josh.
on. But it's not solely about win, about rings and championships. Yes, that elevates you, but it's also about personality, it's about swagger, it's
Exactly,
about all of these
exactly.
different things. Tatum lacks that, which is why
Thank you.
nobody
Right,
pays attention to it. And
right.
that's also why Allen Iverson, even though he never really won anything outside of the MVP, in some ways, well, he was kind of like, I know the mainstream had issues with Iverson, so it's hard to say Iverson was ever really embraced or publicly as the face of the league. But you could argue that for a brief period after Jordan retired, before LeBron comes to the league, that Iverson was, somewhat of the unofficial face of the league. But it was because of his cultural impact and his personality and the way people gravitated towards the way he played the game. Which again is why I think Anthony Edwards, of people who are in the league right now, is the guy to be the face of the league, even though I don't necessarily think he's the best candidate. So.
See, I was gonna get at you. I said, like, I can see Tatum, marketing some sort of drink that you don't want to drink.
But he's gay. I think he's a Gatorade athlete. But the thing, he has all the endorsements. He has Jordan. He has Sprite, I believe. Sprite or
Okay,
Sprite and a
okay,
Gatorade.
okay. You know how you can tell with who's basically is when you watch the jerseys that travel. When
I've
somebody
seen that.
or somebody's not at home game, when people show up, other than here in Washington D.C., where no matter when nobody has a Wizard jersey, but you can really tell that when you are the face of the league, wherever you play, people are going to have your jersey. Okay, and so that's just the marketing thing. Now, I want to get back to Iverson, and I want to link it to what you have an expertise in, and I want you to talk about the groundbreaking things you were doing when you were at Howard University. I want you to talk about the influence of hip hop on the NBA, and
So,
also the course that you developed on hip hop.
okay, so I'll talk about the course last, but in terms of like hip hop in the NBA, like there's been this long connection between the two. I mean, hip hop, I mean, first of all, music and basketball have always really gone hand in hand. I know a lot of lovers of jazz, like yourself, I've heard them say, watching basketball is like playing jazz. It's and here's the funny thing too, I'm gonna tie this back into the book where Dirk Nowitzki had a teacher over in Germany who was trained by a black man named Ernie Butler from the United States who played jazz. And when Dirk Nowitzki, when they would train Dirk, they told him to play basketball as if he was playing jazz. In fact, they would even play jazz music in the practices because they would say, it's all about improvisation and you can't plan a solo, you got to play a solo. And when you're on the court, you can't always plan out your plays. They just have to happen naturally, right? So, you have that connection with basketball and jazz, and then same thing with basketball and hip hop. And, you get, Curtis Blow's song, basketball rap song in the 1980s. There's this famous scene in the hip hop movie Wild Style, of, a basketball game taking place between two of the rival hip hop crews. So as far back as the 80s, and then obviously, think about Spike Lee and the Michael Jordan commercials and She's Gotta Have It, Do the Right Thing, B-Boys, all of that in the 80s, you get this connection of hip hop and basketball. So by the time you move into the 1990s and you have Will Smith, Fresh Prince, wearing the Air Jordan 5s on a number of episodes on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and LL Cool J wearing Jordans on his album covers, it sets the stage for an Allen Iverson who comes into the league in 1996. And you got to also remember that by the time you get into the 90s, those kids, are part of that so-called hip hop generation. They grew up on hip hop more so than maybe older generations would have grown up on R&B and funk and
And then
jazz.
they get the good seats like Drake. They get the good seats. What's up with that, Josh?
I don't know, but Allen Iverson, he becomes the poster child in a lot of ways for hip-hop and the NBA, from the jewelry, from the tattoos, from the cornrows, to just everything he was doing. And the NBA embraced it because, again, they saw that this was a good way for us to market to an audience. This was a good way for us to make money. And it was good for the NBA for a point. And then obviously you think about the Malice in the Palace in the mid-2000s, and then hip hop gets criticized. You know, people say that the NBA has become too much of a hip hop league, and they were associating hip hop with thugs and the streets. And the
didn't like David Stern want to bring back or play like classical music at halftime or something like that?
I don't know if he wanted to take it that far, but he did initiate that dress code, which was anti Allen Iverson. We can't, you know, they wouldn't say that, but it was anti Allen Iverson. It was anti hip hop. So the NBA tried to move away from hip hop for a period, but now we see, like, since the 2010s, they've come back to embracing hip hop. Jay-Z was a minority owner at one point. You have Drake, you mentioned earlier, who has a big role with the Toronto basketball team. You have other hip hop stars who've been involved with NBA franchises over the years. And I mean, the NBA fully embraces hip hop now. And I think part of it too is because hip hop is a lot safer today than it was, say, in the 1990s. You still have like certain aspects of hip hop which people will associate with that thug image. But, you know, hip hop, you know, has a lot of other images now because of the success of people like a Drake or a Kanye West or
talk about hip hop, and this ties in with how we started our program. Talk about hip hop and globalization.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's funny. I taught a class. So you mentioned the class that I developed at Howard University when I was a graduate student there. And we developed a class for undergraduate students, which was offered in Afro-American studies. And then there was a graduate level hip hop seminar, which was offered in the history department as well. And there was this whole hip hop symposium that I used to do as well when I was a student. When I left Howard, I had an opportunity to teach at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for a while. I taught a hip hop class there, and the class there was focused more so on hip hop in the United States. But at my current institution, Trinity, because I'm in a global affairs department, I developed a course on global hip hop, right? Hip hop and globalization. And we talk about how hip hop has spread from the United States overseas. Now, hip hop's always had international roots and ties too. You think about African Bambaataa, who is a child of immigrants. You think about the influences of, you know, not just the music of the Caribbean on early hip hop, but you think a lot of times we call rappers and MCs extensions of the griots from West Africa. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's always been this connection with hip hop, even as far back as the 80s, I think about Fab Five Freddy and what he was doing with the graffiti, and how, he took graffiti from the streets to the art galleries in New York City to overseas, and the breakdancing, which was spread internationally as well. In the global hip hop class that I teach, you know, I look at how you've had instances of, you know, revolutions overseas and the young people overseas in different parts of the globe listening to Fight the Power or playing mm-hmm. Fight the Power as a way to kind of motivate them. I remember there was this one instance where the government banned protests. So what the people did was they would play Fight the Power, or they might play a song from Tupac as their way of being able to still protest, even though they themselves could not speak on behalf of what it was they were fighting for, right? You talk about globalization and hip hop in terms of business and fashion. You know, you look at China, you know, you look at, you know, some of these countries in Asia where you could go over there and you'll see kids wearing the latest Air Jordan. So the latest pair of, well, Yeezys aren't really popular anymore. But, you know, when they were, you know, you would see kids wearing those overseas. And then likewise, you would see those fashions coming back here to the United States, and you would see forward-thinking guys in rap, whether it was a Jay-Z, whether it was a Lupe Fiasco or A$AP Rocky, wearing those fashions from overseas. Now they're wearing them here in the United States. And then the NBA players and the athletes usually are the first ones to kind of mimic that because they have the money to get that attire. And then everyday folks start wearing that too. So, yeah, I mean, again, you know, we talk about globalization and like I said, it's everywhere. It's sports, it's music, it's hip hop, it's, you know, Bad Bunny and Drake being the most streamed artists all over the globe, despite coming from Puerto Rico in Bunny's case and Toronto in Drake's case.
Let's, as we get towards the end of our show, I want to bring in some politics here. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm looking at how when we go back and look at the last couple of years, the impact of police brutality on whether it's the Milwaukee Bucks or Colin Kaepernick, you know, people standing up and taking a position. And I'm wondering, as we look towards like next year and the World Cup, my concern is, you know, we've got ICE running amok right now. What would happen if people had like soccer parties and stuff? Would ICE show up outside? Somebody even start arresting people who want to watch the game? Or, for example, what happened if the soccer team wants to come from Iran? Do we ban them because they're on the list?
That is something we're going to have to think about. You know, definitely. I mean, yeah, obviously, I mean, if we're at war, you know, I don't think we would be welcoming to, you know, a contingent of athletes coming from Iran or coming from, you know, any other country that we may be having a conflict with or that we may have on our ban list. And I think that is going to be.
Should the question be raised about whether we should even host the World Cup with what's going on in our communities?
Definitely. I think so. I mean, same thing with the Olympics. You know, the World Cup is obviously a lot sooner because that's going to be next summer. But then you think about the Olympics coming up in 3 years, right? And will athletes coming from some of those countries be able to come over here and participate? I don't know, man. I think that's a tricky question. That's a tricky question. I don't support, you know, a lot of what's happening in terms of these travel bans and what the president is doing.
But yeah, because, you know, that would be a thing. You say, for example, that used to run Iran as an example. So you let the team in, right? But you don't let the fans in who might want to, you know, come, you know, to see the World Cup.
Yeah, it's almost the like Jalen, and this might not be a good comparison, but I know Jalen Rose, former basketball player, had this quote where he says, "You love our culture, but you don't love us," saying that, you know, people love Black culture, they love Black music, Black athletes, but they don't necessarily love the people, right? The, you know, everybody else. So I think in this particular case, it could be one of those instances where you make, you know, an exception to say, we'll let the athletes come over here, even though, you know, we don't support the rest of the country. We don't support the people, you know, coming from that country who aren't athletes coming to live here in the United States. And then again, it's tricky. It wouldn't surprise me if it happens because, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we see time and time again instances where people will look the other way for the sake of sport, for the sake of money or whatever. And kind of look the other way on the bigger issues that are at play. Now, you know, here's the thing, though. Let me ask you this. Do you think that, like, those athletes, if they come over and they're allowed to participate in the World Cup or in the Olympics, how many of them do you think would use that as an opportunity to do a public protest a la John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Colin Kaepernick, once they get that stage? Do you think that they would be?
Well, I think that what's happened, if you look at all those individuals, they did a, their careers were affected, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's an individual, you know, it's like a Paul Robeson, you know, am I going to speak up? You know, I mean, that's an individual, you know, I mean, I look at Colin Kaepernick, you know what I mean? He sacrificed, you know, for a higher cause. And I think that has a lot to do with what type of athlete you want to be. Okay, and I think that's always going to keep. But, you know, I think coming at the end of our show, Joshua, you know, I see the world moving away from globalization at a time when, you know, sports is pushing us in a different direction. And I'm just wondering, are you optimistic about the future?
I am. I mean, I'm naturally a glass half full person anyway. So I am optimistic. I think that, despite what's happening right now politically in our world, domestically and also internationally, I think that times will get better. It may not happen overnight. It may not happen within the next, year or two. But I do think that eventually, over the next few years, decades, I think, we will be at a better place than we are right now. I think that sports, music, and, just other forms of entertainment are excellent because I think they remind us of the best that we could be as human beings. And I think that, they show us that, the world is much larger than just our backyard and than just,
Okay.
the United
Well, then
States.
my last question, Joshua, right? Are you optimistic about the Washington Wizards?
Not at all. So on
that
that note,
note,
I'm a pessimist.
okay. On that note, we're going to end our show. I want to thank you, Joshua. It's always great talking with you. I miss seeing you, and so this has been really good doing this show. Joshua Wright is my guest today. He's the author of the NBA Global Empire: How the League Became an International Powerhouse. He's also associate professor of history in the Global Studies Department at Trinity Washington University here in D.C. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin, station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Your social justice calendar for the week of June 16th, 2025. On Tuesday evening, June 17th, the esteemed and beloved historian C.R. Gibbs will lead a discussion on Emancipation USA, how freedom came to the DMV and Texas. Mr. Gibbs's lecture will take place at the Woodridge Neighborhood Library in D.C., 1801 Hamlin Street, Northeast, 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 19th, Juneteenth, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Fort Slocum Park, 5800 Kansas Avenue, Northwest D.C., the National Park Service and Rock Creek Conservancy hosts Summer in the Park with fun for all, including music by DJ Lance Reynolds. For more, check out rockcreekconservancy.org. On Thursday, June 19th at 5 p.m., there will be a Speak the Dream Juneteenth Poetry Slam hosted by Black Chakra at the Anacostia location, Busboys and Poets on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast DC. For more info and to RSVP, visit busboysandpoets.com. Sunday, June 22nd from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. at Sankofa, mark your calendars for the third annual Baldwin House Juneteenth celebration on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info and to RSVP, visit Sankofa.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you ready for this Sunday, June 22nd, noon until 8 p.m.? WPFW, in collaboration with Washington Parks and People,
present the Jazz and Justice Festival. This event is an activation of music, poetry, social justice and labor teach-ins, elders circle, visual art, wellness circle, and a kids corner in Malcolm X Park. Performers include Saiz Kamaluddin, Lena Cycli, Lady Murr and Friends, Paul Bailey Quartet, Blacks, Myths, Substantial with DJ RBI, Kaba Soul Singer, Proverbs Reggae Band, and The Soul Searchers, with sets by DJ Abby